Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins says her House is still considering a bill that would close loopholes in the state's sexual assault laws that helped lead to a reversal of the rape conviction of former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. More from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
In late April, the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, overturned Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction on a legal technicality. The judges determined that the trial judge allowed testimony against Weinstein that included allegations from three women about other sexual assaults that were not part of the case that was being tried. In a 4-3 decision, the court said allowing the testimony was an abuse of judicial discretion. The judges did not exonerate Weinstein's behavior. In response, Senate Deputy Majority Leader Michael Gianaris and Assemblywoman Amy Paulin introduced a bill to allow evidence of previous sex crimes to be admitted in sexual assault trials in order to show the accused propensity to commit that act.
We think this is critical to provide justice for survivors of sexual assaults and rapes in our state. Hopefully we'll be able to get there sooner than later because we've already seen the consequences of the muddled state of the law as it exists today.
Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins says her Democratic members are going to decide whether to pass the measure before the session ends in early June.
Obviously, if we are able to get it past the finish line within the next 2 weeks and we think it will be helpful, we would certainly do that.
But defendants' rights groups, including the Legal Aid Society, say the bill is overly broad and could lead to more wrongful convictions that could disproportionately harm Black and Latino New Yorkers. Stewart-Cousins, who helped shepherd in new laws that strengthen defendants' rights, including the 2019 bail reform laws, says those concerns will also be considered when her majority party members meet to talk about the measure.
I think people are very concerned if there, you know, is a loophole that would allow for the courts to feel there's some flexibility in decision-making that we could close. I believe our conference is very interested in addressing that issue.
If lawmakers approve the bill, the new statute could apply to future court action against Weinstein. The Manhattan District Attorney has said he plans to retry the case. Closing the Weinstein loophole is not the only measure that's not yet settled as the 2024 session draws to a close. Senators approved a package of anti-domestic violence bills, but they say the New York State Assembly, also led by Democrats, has not yet agreed to them. Other items still undecided include whether to cut plastic packaging by 50% over the next decade, expand the state's bottle deposit law, and regulate children's access to social media platforms. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Nancy Hagans, president of the New York State Nurses Association. Hagans explained why the association and their members were in Albany this week to rally for safe staffing levels of nurses at the state's hospitals.
It's not being enforced by Department of Health, and we were here on Monday to demand that Department of Health do their job and be transparent. We had a law, and the law we thought was going to help us, and then it's been a year since Department of Health is supposed to be transparent. Go to the hospital and hold the hospital management, you know, they need to be accountable for the staffing. They have not done that. We've had over 1,200 complaints between all the union and Department of Health, maybe have seen 30 of them. And then there's no response and they needed to be transparent because when there's a complaint, Department of Health should investigate and post the result where it's open to the public. No one knows it. I'll give you an example. you know, some of the Albany medical nurses were there. Under the ICU intensive care regulation, there should be one nurse to two patients. There are times the nurses are caring for four patients, and that is a violation of the law. Where is the Department of Health? So we were here on Monday to send a strong message to ask the Department of Health to do their job, to start holding hospitals accountable for the staffing crisis that they have created themselves.
Now, ideally, you'd want full-time nurses in those positions, right? And oftentimes, they have to hire temporary workers to fill those spots or not fill them at all, is what you're saying. And, you know, that's dangerous when you don't have enough nurses to care for people. I'm hearing all sorts of stories anecdotally of people waiting for long periods of time to get care. And you have suggested that a lot of the nurses are leaving the profession, and it sort of seems like a vicious cycle here. How do we get out of it? Is the answer to pay nurses more?
The answer, as I always say, more nurses, better care. The answer is to hire nurses, attract the nurses, and retain them at the bedside. And how is that being done? Is by having proper nurse-to-patient ratios. As a nurse, when you get up, we are the most trusted profession 20 years in a row. There's a reason for that. When we go to work to nurse and care for our patients. I've been a nurse 37 years, and out of the 37 years, I work in the ICU for 23 years, intensive care unit. My goal is to care for my patient. It's the most rewarding profession. When you walk in, you had a very, very sick patient where everybody was day to day, hour to hour. The next day, I walked in and I say good morning to that patient and the patient say good morning to me. That is my biggest reward. But if I'm not able to care for that patient and bring them back to life, that is my greatest defeat. And you're going to say to yourself, I don't want to go back to that position where I cannot help to heal and care for patients. If you're working in a med-surg unit, instead of having five patients, you have 10 patients, then I don't have the time to teach, to make sure that patient is taking the medication, to make sure that patient who just had a cancer diagnosis, that I could sit there and teach them and hold a hand. Because sometimes I'll be the first to tell you, I cry with them, I laugh with them, I smile with them. This is a caring for a person is from head to toe. It's mentally and physically. It is impossible the way the hospital industry decide to do nurse-to-patient ratios. It is impossible for us to deliver safer patient care. Yes, we need to also be paid in order to care for our family. There's inflation. We have to be able to care for our family. We have to be able to afford a place to live, okay? Right here in New York City, we had a lot of great contracts where we achieved pay parities for the public hospitals, the private hospitals are the same aligned. However, staffing is a big problem. No matter how much money you want to pay someone, but we need to still be able to care for our patients. Yes, we need to have good working condition. The good working condition, the most important part of the good working condition is safe patient to nurse ratio. That is the most, not just across New York, across the country. And we are sounding the alarm. Enough is enough. Because if we learn anything during the pandemic, I always knew we didn't have enough nurses. We saw what happened during the pandemic. It's us nurses who saved the state of New York, who saved the country. It's us nurses who went to work every day, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, leaving our children at home by themselves, not able to see them, not able to see our parents, because we had to do what we had to do. We would hope that the hospital industry would say, you know what? It's time to address the situation. It's time to attract nurses and retain the nurses at the bedside. Here in New York State, we have over 1 million nurses that are registered, but most of them are not at the bedside. They decided to walk away from the bedside, from the profession, because of the poor working condition.
That's Nancy Hagans, president of the New York State Nurses Association. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The first class of students in National Grid's Grid for Good program is graduating. The Legislative Gazette's Alexander Babby with more.
The career training program is a collaboration between 518 Elevate Ed and the utility company designed to show participants the variety of jobs available at the company and teach them skills to fill those jobs. Grads were honored at a ceremony at National Grid's facility in Menands Wednesday. 518 Elevate Ed Executive Director Peter Gaback says the training is key with the Capital Region's technology economy booming.
We are known as a STEM hub, the Tech Valley, the Eastern Corridor. So that's certainly something that we want to make sure that the Regenerons, that the Global Foundries have a built-in infrastructure.
National Grid's Patrick Stella agrees that there is intense demand for skilled workers in the field.
With the way the energy is going and the the move towards electrification, there's a lot going on here at National Grid to prepare for that and to make sure that the system's ready for more electric customers, less gas customers, using sustainable energy like wind and solar and other things. We need the workforce.
Stella says National Grid has been making efforts to raise awareness at area schools, adding the process behind turning the lights on is more complicated than just flipping a switch.
If you're going into operations, it's not just you walk in the door and you're on a pole the next day. We have a definite training program that brings our linemen and our gas workers up to speed.
Every meeting starts with a safety briefing, as did graduation, this one conducted by National Grid's Rebecca Atwell, who noted the pros and cons of cell phones.
As we go into the workforce, we want to make sure that we keep them silent if we're in meetings, make sure that we're using them appropriately, make sure that we're giving our number to one of the folks that we trust or if it's business related.
While no plans for a second class between 518 Elevate Ed and National Grid have been announced, 518 Elevate Ed Treasurer Fariza Islam Hanif says talks are underway.
We're, evaluating the program and hopefully getting feedback from everybody, but we're really hopeful that this partnership can continue because we see it as a great benefit both for National Grid and for 518 Elevate Ed, for the students and the local communities.
She says as a 518 Elevate Ed program graduate, being a board member is her way of giving back to a program that meant so much to her. Quenisha Williams from Schenectady is a new program graduate. She says she'd never considered working for National Grid before finding out about the opportunity after seeing the poster on a wall.
You had to write an essay to get in, and I don't remember what I wrote in the essay. I just wrote something about wanting to do something more with my life, and the program looked very interesting. National Grid obviously is a big company, so if they were interested in people in my community and I'm a person in my community, then I'm interested back in them.
She says receiving the email that she was one of the 20 selected out of an applicant pool of 60 helped raise her self-esteem.
Just boost my confidence through the roof, like I was hand-selected. And, the little kid in me just remembers not getting picked for kickball until, the last one stand. So the fact that I was even picked for something had me stoked.
Williams says as a black woman, she's breaking the mold.
All the people in the previous class looked like me and looked like my family members. So that was the inspiration right there, like saying, why not, why shouldn't we try to go after this?
She says she sees herself as a pioneer in the field as National Grid ramps up future-ready electrification efforts.
When we're working with National Grid, we're kind of like on the ground level of that. Like when we're old ladies in rocker chairs and all of this way of life is all solar and electric, we'll look back and say, well, we were there when it was just gas and ash. We know when, we were there at the ground floor.
Shamir Bird, senior of Troy, who also graduated Wednesday, says while he's worked in construction before, this program made him feel comfortable pursuing electrical work. He says he's not sure of his next steps, but no matter where life leads.
I'm hoping to fully capitalize on this experience, capitalize on the opportunities that's been laid out in front of me, and getting up, dressing up, and showing up, and achieving my goals.
Program graduates are also given a $1,200 stipend they're able to use as they see fit.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Alexander Babby.
Advocates are making their voices heard about the potential harms of the new drug dealer registry in Rensselaer County. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons with that story.
The countywide registry, approved unanimously by county legislators earlier this year, with support from the district attorney, aims to track county residents convicted of drug sale crimes by publicly recording their names and addresses. It was announced with fanfare in January when Republican County Legislator Bruce Pettieri, who represents District 5, said his objective is to, quote, make it more difficult for these people to thrive, unquote.
We have to help the people in our community protect their children by making sure these people are put away. They're bad people and they should be in jail. And they're not, these drug dealers are being released.
Since then, local opposition has grown. Damaris Miller, a Troy resident and an organizer with Troy for Black Lives, says registries isolate people, often making situations worse.
Registries have been proven over and over again to not actually have any meaningful impact on reducing the rate of sexual assault or rape or any type of sexual crime. Actually, what happens for folks on those registries is that they get further isolated from resources, from community. It's harder for them to find employment, housing, access to social services, all of those things that would help them to actually break the cycle of violence and heal themselves.
Melanie Trimble is the regional director with the New York Civil Liberties Union.
The impact on people on the registry may be a major cause for reoffense, given the difficulty people experience with job loss, social stigma, and shame, and not being able to integrate back into the community.
County legislator Peter Grimm, who represents District 1, says he's glad the community is engaging with the legislation, but he wishes it happened sooner. The minority Democrat says he and some of his colleagues plan to introduce legislation to repeal the local law.
I do not know of any solution that's going to solve our drug problem or solve the problem of having drug dealers in our community. But I think everyone needs to be part of the conversation to help us all get there. I think, you know, we've identified the problem, but we haven't had a conversation to find the solutions. And that's where I think we have to begin.
Grimm says he and some fellow lawmakers are considering the legality of the law after advocates presented what he called, quote, very strong points, unquote, against the legislation at a recent meeting. The Rensselaer County District Attorney, Mary Pat Donnelly, declined to comment on the legislation. The county legislature's attorney, Phil Danaher, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Miller says if the law can't be repealed, he would like to see it go unenforced.
We're very conscious of the fact that this is the first county in the state to institute this type of law, and so we really want to nip this in the bud before it's exported to other counties.
Courtney Lovell, a recovering substance user in Troy, says the legislation isolates people struggling with addiction. She says the county should focus on supporting them instead of ostracizing them.
When people are resorting to criminal behaviors or selling drugs for income, it's because they're lacking other resources and ways to thrive in society. So again, the solution lies in creating more opportunities for people to have better employment, to have better education, to have more stable housing, not in finding ways to make those things further out of reach.
The registry, which was planned to launch in February, has not yet been made public. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
In April 2022, New York approved a state budget that includes a provision mandating that all school buses purchased by 2027 must be zero emission and all district fleets must transition by 2035. In a conversation with the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley, NYSERDA Director of Clean Transportation Adam Reuter explains what schools will need to do and says the agency is helping schools transition.
What we're really doing right now is encouraging schools to start by undertaking a fleet electrification plan. This helps schools understand how electric buses can fit into their specific needs and requirements, their terrain, their climate, their bus routes, their logistics. And then we're really encouraging schools to start buying one or two electric buses now. We think that that is the best way to help them get some experience with the buses. Understand what works for them, what is different about these buses, what's the same about the buses. Help train the drivers, help train the mechanics, and you know, demystify an electric bus. Even in rural districts, the average bus route is only about 70 or 80 miles a day. And typical electric buses have a range of 100 to 200 miles today. So this is an attainable and achievable opportunity for every district in the state.
You said 70 to 80 miles is the average route, but how far can they go on an average charge?
The typical electric bus can go between 100 and 200 miles on a charge.
How are you working with the school districts to deal with the lack of infrastructure, but these very large distances without the EV infrastructure?
It's a great question. What we're really encouraging schools to do is to start off with the easiest to electrify routes. The technology is continuing to improve, and between now and 2035, which is more than a decade, the technology is going to take leaps and bounds forwards. And as the technology improves and the schools get more experience with actually operating these buses, and we have a chance to build out more charging infrastructure across the state, then we'll deal with the tougher routes.
Adam Reuter, have you heard concerns from school districts, particularly in the North Country, about the climate aspects of this? We get really cold. Well, we're supposed to get really cold in the winters in this region.
Yes, some schools have expressed concerns about cold weather operations. And electric school buses do, you know, take a range hit in the winter, but diesel buses also operate less efficiently in the winter as well. It is a challenge, but there are ways to address it. We've seen good examples of schools that have been able to integrate buses in cold weather climates. There are over 200 electric school buses operating in Quebec right now. We've heard good success stories from school districts out near Buffalo and Montana, North Dakota. So this isn't just hypothetical. Schools are integrating electric buses into their operations in cold weather climates.
The cost of buses, the EV buses are almost double what a diesel bus costs. How big a concern are you finding that is right now for the potential transition?
You're right. The upfront cost of an electric school bus is significantly more than a diesel bus. But NYSERDA offers a school bus incentive program that can cover up to 100% of the difference in cost between a diesel bus and an electric bus. Our program also covers much of the cost of the charging infrastructure. There's also US EPA funding through the Clean School Bus Program that can cover a major portion of the cost, up to 90 or 95% of the cost of the bus. And there are programs from the utilities, from the electric utilities, to help cover some of the infrastructure costs. There are also tax credits from the federal government that are now able to be claimed by non-taxable entities like school districts. So when you combine all of those, often the electric bus can be less expensive than a diesel once you've factored in all of those.
Adam Reuter, I looked at one of the schools in New York that has gotten two EVs so far, and that's Alexandria Bay. And it wasn't just, oh, we're going to go out and buy an EV bus and put it on the road. They looked at grants, which you've mentioned, but they had to have a national grid site survey done. They had to have a bus route analysis done, and they had to do an electrical update to their garage. That sounds like those are additional expenses and additional considerations. Are these typical things that schools will have to consider? And are there other things that schools will have to look into?
Schools will need to look at a number of different factors when they're considering an electric bus purchase. Fortunately, NYSERDA has funding for schools to do a fleet electrification plan, and we'll cover up to 100% of that cost. That will look at the bus routes that a school has, look at the terrain and the climate, look at the electrical needs at the facility, look at the size of buses that they're operating now and the number of buses that they're operating now, and help them come up with a plan of what it will take to electrify their fleet. The utilities also will help by providing, at no cost to the district, an analysis of what electrical upgrades might be needed at their facility. And we encourage every school district to take that as a first step in this process. But doing that study is really important to help you understand what's needed for your school district. And as I said, that's something that the state can cover the cost of.
Why do we need to transition to EV buses?
The transportation sector makes up about 30% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions. And there are more than 45,000 school buses in New York State, more than in any other state. School buses are a big piece of that emissions. Diesel school buses have negative health effects for students by breathing in the diesel fumes that can drift back into the bus. So we see electric school buses as a way to improve student health, improve safety. They are more cost effective, so they're going to help us meet our greenhouse gas goals, improve student health, and improve the safety of our communities.
Can the state meet the 2035 goal, considering how many schools there are, how many buses need to be replaced?
The only way to know is if we start.
New York voters approved an environmental bond act that includes $500 million to help fund the transition to electric buses. Some Republicans in the legislature have called for the mandate to be rescinded or replaced with a pilot program. In March, an amendment to a bill offered by Republican Senator George Borrello of the 57th District to replace the mandate with a feasibility study was defeated. Dan Stack, a Republican from the 45th District, calls the EV bus mandate, quote, expensive and unfeasible, unquote. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2420. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.